Hello, this is Bob, and I just wanted to let you know that this is not an ordinary non-zero podcast. It's a conversation I had on another podcast, the Buddhist Geeks podcast, with a host, Vincent Horn, whom I've known for a while, and who was, in fact, a guest on my own podcast some years back. The title Vince gave the conversation is Meditating on Palestine. We talked about the Israel-Palestine conflict and the Gaza war in particular, from what you could call a standpoint of mindfulness, I guess, and from a standpoint of kind of Buddhist philosophy more broadly. And Vince also talked about it from his own perspective as someone of Palestinian descent who has had some challenging conversations about this subject with various people in his life, including some in the Buddhist meditation community. Now, this was taped in late September, shortly before the Gaza ceasefire was announced, but I think everything in it remains relevant for better or worse. So I hope you'll check it out. I think it's a very valuable conversation, and I hope you'll keep track of Vince's work at the Buddhist Geeks podcast and Substack.
I'm doing this series on Buddhist Geeks now called Meditating on Palestine. That was it's a very personal topic, because I've shared with you that I'm part Palestinian on my mom's side. My grandfather, who passed away a few years ago, Latif, he was born in Palestine and left during what they called the Nakba in 1948. He was 15 at the time. So he came to America and settled here, was able to do that amazingly. And so I've been really wanting to meditate on the sort of American convert Buddhist response to Palestine as a Dharma teacher and Palestinian American. Someone this is very personal for, and also just want to understand, you know, what's happening right now. It feels like an important time to be speaking about this, because it's so many people's lives are directly affected by what's happening in Palestine and Gaza in particular. Yeah, I wanted to talk to you because you're talking about these topics regularly. You obviously seem to be thinking a lot about them. You seem to be taking in a lot of information, and I really appreciate not having spent a lot of time until recently really trying to understand the geopolitics and the history and sociology of this kind of stuff, the psychology of it, because it's too close to home. It's like too painful to look at, which maybe that's something we can talk about. We explore the Jewish Buddhist response, why it's been so paltry. I think there are reasons that I can look at my own experience as a Palestinian American I can relate to, actually, and have some compassion, empathy for. So I wanted to surface in some of those things, but I also want to just get your, so this is Buddha, this is, we're having this conversation with my intention to share it on Buddhist Geeks, but it's also, I'm just assuming this could be shared anywhere. And I'd love to hear your perspective on what's happening right now in Palestine. I know I saw you just posted something less than an hour ago on Israel, Gaza, and free speech in America. So we're at this critical injunction point, September 23rd, 2025, where like things are really intense, at least relatively speaking. And you've been really tracking this. So I wanted to get your perspective on what's happening from a geopolitical perspective. How would you describe it? And then I'm curious to talk about whatever you want to talk about too, and with respect to this topic. I should mention you wrote the book, Why Buddhism is True, which is another reason this made sense to me to have this conversation with you, because you've got a foot, or at least a toe or something, or I don't know how many toes you have, you'd have to say, in the Buddhist world. Anyway, just curious to hear your thoughts.
Yeah. So should I just start giving thoughts, or?
However you like to do it, Bob, I'm open. What do you like to do in dialogue?
Yeah, I mean, my own awareness of Middle East stuff has been, it's surfaced intermittently, but it began back in the 80s when I was in the New Republic, at the New Republic, and which was owned by a pretty ardent Zionist named Marty Peretz. And before I spent, I guess, 7 months as acting editor, he thought I should take a trip to Israel. And so he paid for it. He set up a lot of the conversations for me. In fact, oddly, I had a 1 hour one-on-one conversation on a park bench with Bibi Netanyahu, who was at that point an up-and-coming member of the Knesset, and the government people wanted me to talk to him. The New Republic magazine was at least considered very important in Israel at that point, because it was a liberal but supportive of Israel under Marty's ownership. Anyway, so I talked to the people he wanted me to talk to. That was illuminating. But I also went to an Arab village within Israel, in Israel proper, And that visit had been set up by the publicist at my publisher at that time, named Sandra, I think, Browarski. It's been a long time. So I started to get the other side of the picture. There was a really salient moment when my wife and I, and Marty, God bless him, paid for my wife to go to. It was a restaurant. I think it didn't work out the way he'd hoped. In part because of this one conversation in a restaurant in, I think, Jerusalem. There was a Palestinian waiter, and that was more common back then because that was before, it was actually during the first Intifada, but that wasn't very violent. After, I think, the second Intifada is when they built the wall between the West Bank and Israel, more or less. And so there were a lot of Palestinians who went back and forth in those days. In fact, one thing that's been lost as a result of that whole, the wall and everything, is cultural interchange between Israelis and Palestinians. But I remember when he found out we were from America, you can tell he really wanted to tell us his story. And he did it almost covertly, like he was looking around. I think he didn't want to see his boss probably. Didn't want his boss to see him spending a lot of time in an overly long conversation with a couple of Americans. But he was describing what it's like to go through the checkpoint every day. And he said, I don't know, well, what's your policy on swearing on your...
I'm fine with it.
Yeah. I won't even do it. I'll just say that what he said was this, and people will know the verb he really used. He said he'd go through the checkpoint, and there would be these Israeli soldiers his age, and they might like, and they've got rifles, and they might say something like, have you been screwing any Jewish girls? And except it wasn't screwing, it was a little more graphic. And I thought, so you've got one ethnic group that just has complete power over another one, including the power to intimidate and humiliate them. You've got like, this guy was young. Yeah, so you've got like 18, 19-year-old males on both sides, and one side has guns. There's intense, fairly intense hostility, at least among some of them. And I just thought, this is not a good situation. But that and visiting the Arab village allowed me to see things from the Palestinian point of view. And I don't personally feel like I have a dog in the fight, so to speak. I hope nobody on either side finds that offensive, that metaphor, but I'm not Jewish. I'm not Palestinian. I was not all that aware of the conflict at all until I got to the New Republic, because it was very central to the conversation there, or at least very prominent. So anyway, when I tracked things from then on, and I don't know, once you've seen the Palestinian side, you just start realizing that the side that's being presented in American media isn't exactly a balanced perspective by and large. And so I think I actually am able to see things from both sides fairly well. It's not like I think it's monsters on either side. In fact, in a way, I think people on both sides are reacting, given the history. Once you understand the history and the politics and everything of both sides, as brutal as a lot of the stuff has been, none of it's in a way completely surprising. What bothers me is that in America, a lot of people think only one side is surprising, right? They see this monstrous thing done on October 7th, and they think history starts there. Now, to say that history doesn't start there, and that there was a reason October 7th happened, is not to excuse it any more than to say that October 7th triggered what we've seen since then from Israel is to justify that. But it's, in both cases, there are causal factors. And so I don't know. I have spoken out about it more than is common. It's in America. It's gotten more common, especially among younger people. Like my daughters, they go to the demonstrations. They were arrested for refusing to disperse in ceasefire demonstrations. Most of the friends with them were Jewish.
Yeah.
Who also got arrested because
I've seen a lot of them. Yeah.
Among the younger people, it's just a different vibe altogether. Not that there aren't ardently Zionist young Jews, but
the
lay of the land is very different. But among my generation, it's like, what's the upside of speaking out? You may offend some Jewish friend without knowing it. It's not like they're going to call you and complain, probably, but you may do it. You may, it's just the incentive structure about speaking out. It does not, at least for, I think, people in my generation, does not encourage it. But it's funny, just being at the New Republic, which is was at least a very Jewish place. Mike Kinsley, who was the editor and was Jewish, he said there were three offices in a row, me and Fred Barnes and Mort Kondracki. None of us drank. And he used to refer to that as the row of righteous Gentiles as like a joke, because we were the three Gentiles in the office. A row of righteous Gentiles, for people who don't know, is a term applied to certain Gentiles who played a certain role, I think, during the Holocaust, I believe. But I don't know, somehow that made me more comfortable just speaking candidly about my views. The fact that I just felt like, I don't know, I was, people at New Republic were my friends, and I just felt so I could speak honestly to them, and they were Jewish. And like Peter Beinart was there. We had some overlap with Peter Beinart. Now, there's another guy who didn't follow exactly the path that Marty would have liked. As time went on, Peter got more and more, his views came more and more to my liking about foreign policy in general. And certainly on Israel, he's well known for being left of center. So anyway, I guess that's how I got here. I pay attention to foreign policy these days fairly broadly, and I say things about other aspects of American foreign policy. But I certainly don't think it makes sense for us to be sending weapons to Israel when what's going on is going on.
Genocide is the term that's becoming more, I guess there's a wider acceptance of the possibility that's happening. And, you know,
I've always been very conservative in my usage of that term, meaning I don't apply it broadly. Like the State Department says that the Chinese are doing it to the Uyghurs. I don't use it there. I haven't been using it about Gaza. Now, war crimes are definitely being committed. Forced displacement is a war crime, and atrocities are being committed and so on. And I almost don't know in a way how much it matters. For some practical purposes, it matters what you call it, but you're certainly right. It's more and more common. I heard somebody just the other day say they're now using the term and they hadn't been using the term. I forget who it was.
From a Buddhist ethical standpoint, let's like look at it from that point of view. Like it matters from an ethical or moral position, because does it matter? Like mass atrocities and mass murder versus trying to wipe out, like having the intention to wipe out a people, like an ethnic group. I don't know. There may be shades or degrees delusional intention.
Yeah, although to my mind, according to Buddhist ethics, you certainly don't need to call it genocide to say this is wrong.
For sure. It's pretty
clear. And there are particular passages that come to mind. There's one that means something like hatred doesn't cease through more hatred.
Right.
Hatred provokes more hatred. That I think that's true in a very practical sense. Like,
right.
That Israel, there may be a price to pay for what they're doing down the road. They've created a whole generation of young males who are teenagers or will soon be teenagers who have killed or maimed family members. And
yep.
Some of them are going to be willing to do some pretty extreme things. And so I just think that part of Buddhism is right. Just as a practical matter, giving vent to your hatred doesn't help. And of course, the Buddhist ethical take on violence generally is well known.
Yeah, especially the early Buddhist take, which is more the popular notion of it. And it's pretty clear, yeah. I think there's some later Buddhisms that you could look at violence in a slightly different way, like in the Tantric
traditions. There always are.
Yeah.
With all these traditions, yeah.
Yeah. And the Buddhists have a history, right? That's something that I found quite interesting learning about Buddhist history as a religious studies student, was like how much of contemporary Buddhist history is a history of people who had aggressors who came in and invaded their country, like Thich Nhat Hanh and the Dalai Lama, both two of the most like luminary Buddhist figures, were refugees from their own country. I think it's interesting to see just how like contemporary Buddhist teachers have worked with this. And I think the argument can be made, and I've thought about this before, like the nonviolent approach is the approach where you're basically like, okay, let the Chinese come in, or we'll just cede this land without a fight and expect greater wisdom to prevail when greater wisdom is not to be found.
I'm not like a pacifist. It's not like there's no circumstances under which I would say that fighting is justified. But what's going on now, I think, is in addition to being just horrible, is counterproductive from Israel's point of view. In any event, it doesn't make sense for my country to be supporting it.
Yeah, that's where I agree as an American. I'm like, why are we doing this?
Yeah. Now, it's funny. I've, even before all this, I've been disappointed in the shortage of kind of American Buddhists who seemed interested in speaking out about foreign policy in general, or seemed interested in foreign policy or international affairs. Right. It's like when you go to, if you go to Insight Meditation Society for a retreat or something, you look at the bumper stickers. I guess there are some kind of peace signs maybe, but there's a big eco vibe. There's a lot of like ecology and pro-environmental values are a big thing. But, and I think everyone would be happy to go to a march on climate change or something. But I have not seen much Buddhist activism on just like American militarism, for example, which would have made sense to me for a long time. If you look at the way we've been using military force.
You know, when I think about this too, I think I can think of some small groups, like there's like the Engaged Buddhist movement, but they're pretty small. I think more of individuals here rather than like movements. And I think that's indicative of kind of the American convert Buddhist approach to this. Yeah. It's very hyper individualistic, and it fits within that cultural matrix just fine. But it doesn't look at the, when you scrutinize that and say, wait a second, but you're American, so you're participating in whatever this American thing is now, whatever you call it. And then it's okay, by participating in it, you are part of it. Even if it's a small part, you're still participating. So that's karma from a Buddhist standpoint. What kind of karma are you generating? If you're just ignoring it, not talking about it, just trying to be peaceful as you go on long retreats. While I remember going on long retreats while, how many Arabs died while I was on retreat? And not just like Arab terrorists, but like Arab civilians, like a lot. And here I am just like being okay, peacefully meditating. It's like, how does that work?
Yeah, it points to a kind of a long-standing question about Buddhism. Do some people use the practice, the meditative practice in particular, to basically buffer themselves from the harshness of the world?
100%. You
know, as a refuge.
I've done it. Haven't you?
Yeah, that's part of the idea. But at the same time, I take part of the idea, or at least the idea I would like to put out there, is that you can use the equanimity you get to engage in the world more skillfully.
Yeah, that's...
Guided by the values that we associate with.
Yeah, things like wisdom and compassion. And even I love the Christian values. Let's throw mercy and grace in there as well. Why not?
Yeah, by the way, the verse, if your enemy is thirsty, give him drink. If your enemy is hungry, give him food. If you read the whole thing, what it says next is, because by doing so, and this appears both in the Hebrew Bible and in the New Testament, because Paul basically recites it, referring to the Hebrew Bible. And the next line is, for by doing so, you pour hot coals down his back, or something like that. And the point is that it's actually a skillful strategy to not hate your enemy. There are different interpretations of this, but I think I would say the mainstream interpretation of this verse is that it is, in addition to being maybe just ethically right in a pure sense, not to hate, it can also be a skillful practice, even as applied to your enemy, because it frustrates them. They often want you to hate them. They often want you to do the things you would do if you hated them.
To justify a nasty response.
Yeah, justifies an answer song. It may play into their hands.
Like October 7th.
As I said, I think this may come back to haunt Israel, what the response has been. Now they may go all the way and just ethnically cleanse Gaza wholesale and even the West Bank. And then maybe they'll say, see, we're really secure now. I don't know, but I think they're probably courting trouble down the road. Anyway, yeah, I agree with you. These values can be found in all the great spiritual traditions. But at the way this use of the practice
to spiritual bypassing
can be overdone. And
right. And just to play off what you're saying, like I've heard the term spiritual bypassing used by the late psychologist John Woolwood, which is a great term to describe using spiritual practices and awarenesses to bypass your personal neurotic shadow type stuff. And that's an interesting use of it. But here we're talking about a different kind of bypass where you're bypassing stuff that's happening in the world. You're using your spiritual thing. And it's like the same move, but it's toward a different dimension of experience. So I don't know if there's a term for that, but probably someone's coined that at some point. But if there isn't, we need to figure out what it is, because that's a certain kind of bypassing. It's like a political bypassing. And that's like specifically tuning out what's happening in the third person perspective of like objective systems and like governance and business and all these things, law, are all happening in this space. And it's like, if you're just paying attention to your breath, it's okay. That's not arising when I pay attention to my breath.
Yeah.
It's arising when I look at non-zero.
I was disappointed. I was talking to somebody pretty prominent in the American Buddhist community, well-known meditation teacher. You'd know the name.
Uh-huh.
This was years ago. And he just said all this fighting and around the world and stuff. And he said, I just think it's going to go on forever. And I thought, I don't know. Isn't the ultimate purpose of trying to spread the Dharma to increase the chances of it actually changing in a fundamental way at some point?
Yeah. Some of the mentors that I learned the most from, people like David Loy and Ken Wilber, integral philosopher, they both said the same thing independently, which was like, there's this sort of saying, form is emptiness, emptiness is form, in the Mahayana Buddhist tradition, from the Heart Sutra. And they both said, form is emptiness, emptiness is evolving, because we know that the world of form is evolving. And that's one of our best stories to describe the nature of change of the world of form. And our Buddhist understanding should be about Dharma as evolution. This is actually what emptiness is, the evolutionary process through that's happening through us.
You would hope.
Evolution has lots of dead ends, right?
But I think it really needs to happen. I think evolution, I'm actually writing about this now.
I know you're an evolutionary psychologist.
Yeah,
right? Part of your background?
But I wrote a...
You studied enough.
...pretty book. About
you read a book on it. Shouldn't technology. You be given an honorary degree? I feel like
I accept that. Thank you, Vince. I'm
handing them out today.
Thank you for asking me here today, and all my remarks will be brief. Where was I? Oh yeah, when you think of like technological evolution in that sense, and kind of cultural evolution more broadly, just the stuff that the evolution that has transformed the world over the last couple thousand years, right? Just changes in traditions and beliefs and ideas and technology in particular, I think it's pushing us toward a point where we really need to upgrade our ethical game. And I think it's actually done some of that by making people from distant lands interdependent and so on. It's made them, at least in some cases, more tolerant of one another than was the norm a couple thousand years ago. But I think we need to get a lot better, because I think the technologies that are coming along, the technologies that are here, starting with nuclear weapons, including biologic weapons and so on, I think call for more and more in the way of international governance of a kind that cannot happen unless some of the international conflict subsides. I think AI is going to put that in overdrive personally. We're not going to, if we do not govern that collectively as a planet, we're in trouble. So I think we're being pushed by technological evolution to make a decision. Like, either we move. It's funny, I'm writing like exactly this part of the book right now, and I'm trying to figure out a way to convey it. But it's, I think, the degree of concord necessary to govern something like AI, because it's such a governance challenge. We're just so far from the kind of mindset we need, the ethical behaviors we need and the corresponding mindset we need, that to say we need to get a little better morally just doesn't do it justice.
Right.
I think we need to move a little closer to actual enlightenment. Like on a meditation retreat, I can only speak for myself. Like I don't feel like, okay, I've attained enlightenment at this moment, but I think, okay, this is movement along the path. Like the way I feel now, like my classic example is sitting in a meditation retreat, and you have a looser and looser attachment to the things within yourself, including your feelings and so on. your bounds just start feeling more porous. And at some point, it's like I feel a tingling in my foot. I hear a singing bird, and the tingling doesn't seem like more a part of me than the bird singing. That bird singing doesn't seem any less part of me than right. the tingling. And at that point, I think, okay, this is not some kind of full-on not self experience, but I'm starting to get the idea. And corresponding to that, your view of other human beings at that point is so much more ethically enlightened than your ordinary view of human beings, at least in mine, because I walk around, I'm a person, I judge people unfairly, I judge people on the basis of little evidence, I judge people harshly. And get into the mindset that a good meditation retreat can move you towards, it's just like a totally different mindset and clearly a more enlightened one, clearly a more morally advanced one, where you just, other people seem as important as you.
Less judgmental. Okay, this is good.
I think the world needs to move closer to this. And as crazy as it sounds, I'm not saying it's going to work. I'm just saying we better think about it. Because
yeah,
you cannot go on like this.
It's
crazy.
I agree with you on that. Here's the challenge I see as someone who's done a lot of retreat practice and even teaches retreats. I still see there's like a massive problem with the neo-monastic model in our culture, the ability for it to actually impact people's real lives, because it requires so much investment of time and resources, financial as well as time. And usually if people have financial resources, they don't have time resources. And likewise, so it's like you have to have both to do a decent amount of retreat practice. And the retreat teachers will argue you need to do a decent amount to really get the depth of what they're trying to teach there. For me, it was like I did a year in my 20s in total, and that seemed to be enough to get the idea of, okay, this is crazy. You can go really deep in consciousness. But the problem is coming back and bridging the gap between these really deeply contemplative, introspective experiences where you're living in an environment that's intentionally constrained, it's simplified. I think it makes you more morally like good because you're paying more attention and because you're living in a simpler environment where you're not talking. You literally, on most of these retreats, you're not even talking to people. You can't even, as one of my Jewish mentors, Dave Goldblum, said, you can't even step on your own dick when you're on retreat.
I'd never thought of it that way. I have to know.
But there is something to that where we're designing an environment it's like the kindergarten of contemplative ethical training. Like
because you go back playing with the blocks. World.
Yeah. We're playing
and
with
it's
the blocks.
So different that it doesn't convey. Is that what you mean?
A huge amount of non-conveyance happens. And that's why I spent the last 15 years obsessed with things like social meditation techniques, because I bridge these deep introspective first person experiences that I had on retreats with being married, having a kid, and having business and hornets in my invading my yard.
Yeah. I'd say two things. One is, although that's true, I still think there's value in it and having the kind of experience I just described.
Yeah.
So that you think, okay, that is much closer than the idea.
Look at how shitty I am.
Really, honestly, I don't think you get too hard on yourself, but it's good to have something closer to an ideal in mind, to know it's in principle possible.
In principle,
and to know it's closer to the truth about the world, to have that feeling that this is a clearer view of the world and it's a truer view of the world. And it's closer to moral truth, and it's better, and it's my ideal, and now I know something about it. But the other thing I'd say is I agree that you need to turn life into practice. Another part of this chapter I'm writing is just talking about how, you know, when you're on social media, I'm not speaking to Buddhists or meditators, I'm just saying, when you're on social media, one thing you can try is, if you feel like sharing content, retweeting something, or you don't, pay attention to your feelings. Like, what feeling is driving you to want to retweet something that is by someone in your ideological tribe and it agrees with your views, and there is a feeling. You see it and you like it and you embrace it and you want to spread it. And this is another, and you want to spread it without even examining it. Whereas if you see information from somebody in the other tribe and it seems to be evidence contrary to your worldview, it's like you get this negative feeling, you don't trust it, you don't like it, you want to inspect it and see if it's really valid. You don't want to inspect the stuff that your tribe made. You just retweet it without examining how valid the claim is or whatever. And these are feelings, and I think they are really what underlies what we call cognitive biases. This is confirmation bias at work. To embrace evidence that's favorable to your existing worldview and reject the other kind, or interrogate it critically. And it's feelings that drive it. But anyway, what I was going to say was, then I go on to say in what I'm writing, like, okay, so when you do this on social media, like, that is mindfulness. It's not mindfulness meditation, but it is being more aware of your feelings. And there is a kind of straight line almost from that to something closer to a not self experience at a meditation retreat. Meditation starts with an exercise that's simple. You just pay attention to the feelings you're having. And you'd be surprised how far just getting more skillful at that can take you and more immersed in that. And so anyway, yeah, I second the motion that it's good for us all to remember that we can practice anytime, anywhere. And in fact, that's when it's most needed, in real life.
Yes, absolutely. Yeah, when you describe that kind of experience of being mindful on social media, to me, that's a very important kind of, I call it like a life practice. You're intentionally bringing mindfulness into the context of your life in some situation, and you have that intention, and sometimes you remember to do it, and you're like, oh, cool, like I'm being mindful of the response, and shit, I sense it anyway, because I was pretty like inflamed, and I...
It happens.
Right, it does happen. But that's part of the process of the mindfulness you're talking about. What I love about the way you're talking about that, Bob, is like it highlights the way that mindfulness as an intervention can really be a kind of agency inflator. It helps increase the amount of agency that's possible in that moment.
Exactly what I'm saying, because the book is about artificial intelligence, and it's about...
Oh, cool.
AI... humans slowly transferring agency to AI. And we want to be careful about how we do that. And we want to preserve our agency. We want to make the decision and not have the decision made for us what parts of our agency we hang on to.
Yeah, we want to maintain agency of our agency, meta agency. That makes sense.
Yeah.
Yeah, and I guess... when I look at it from that point of view, I see these two things almost at odds. They are at odds, maybe at war. It's like on the one hand, you have like personal mindfulness, which helps empower agents to interact with their environment and each other and themselves more skillfully. And then you have these like technologies that are designed in every way to hook those individuals and for them to lose their agency to the interacting networks they're in. And you have this kind of, it seems like the technologies are winning in large part because of our economic system supports them and incentivizes them. So you get, this is what American capitalist Buddhism looks like, is we design systems that hijack our attention for us. And then we get pissed at ourselves because we're so terrible at being mindful.
Yeah.
I know, it's a little bit, it's a provocative way that I'm framing it here, but that's partially true, I think.
Optimizing for engagement, as they say in the algorithm business,
yeah, that's a nice way
of putting it. And it's the same incentive with AI to large. It depends on your business model, technically, but you're right. For many business models, you want to keep people engaged. And keeping them engaged is a kind of a polite way of saying control their minds, sap their ability to go somewhere else.
Yeah. The best way to do that is to sap their agency, which is the opposite of mindfulness, what mindfulness does.
That's right. No, that's right. And I think there should be a natural intersection between mindfulness, the whole mindfulness Buddhist community, and the dialogue about how we're going to handle AI.
I've seen there's stuff starting to happen around that again. Like there was some activity maybe 10 years ago with the IEET, the Institute for Emerging Ethics and Technology. And I remember being tapped for that. I was too busy as a new father to join that conversation. But lately, I saw another group has started to pick this back up, the Buddhism and AI exchange. Huh. So that's cool to see that's reemerging. But I agree with you 100%.
Oh my gosh.
Yeah, there's going back to some of your original insights on meditation retreats, which I totally agree with, a sense of interconnection, of not feeling like such hard boundaries and edges mm-hmm. between me and everything else. It's okay, if I were able to take that out of kindergarten and bring it into the grad school of life, then and what would that look like? Like, it probably look like being in conflict, but handling it better. And it would look like bad stuff happening, but catching it quicker before it becomes like a calamity. What's happening in Gaza to me, it's like a calamity because it's been happening for so long and it could have been averted in some realities of the multiverse. It has been probably.
You hope.
Yeah.
I was in one.
Yeah, it's the same here.
Yeah, it's hard. I don't know. So I assume you've been to Israel and...
I have not been. I begged my grandfather to bring me to the Middle East with him, and he wouldn't. I don't speak Arabic, so it'd be difficult for me to navigate. I have family in the West Bank. That's my primary connection right now. And of course, family in Jordan and other parts of the Middle East. But a lot of my family members are connected to folks in the West Bank. So right now, it's very
you have
real.
Like what, cousins? And
I have a cousin. Yeah, a cousin and her husband and their three kids. And her father is my uncle, and he lives in my neighborhood. So I see him regularly, and I ask, how's my cousin doing? And it's one that's like, we don't hear much because of the situation there in terms of digital surveillance. Like, she's scared to say much to anyone.
And now she's in Jordan or the West Bank?
She's in the West Bank. But there's certain times where things get really bad, like outside of in their town. And she'll call her dad and be like, I'm really scared. And it's heartbreaking to hear that people are living in such fear.
It's obviously terrible in Gaza, but it's gotten a lot worse.
Yeah, it's hard to compare them because it's so terrible in Gaza. But anyway, I worry about my family, obviously. Yeah, for sure.
Yeah, I just taped a conversation for my podcast, the Non-Zero podcast, with Rob Malley, who was on the American negotiating team at Camp David and has been involved intermittently, and he just came out with a book co-authored with a guy who was on the Palestinian team at Camp David called Tomorrow is Yesterday, I think. And I've listened to the book, and he does a good job of seeing the perspectives on both sides, but the two sides tend not to. That's partly what the book is about, how at the various negotiations, the actors on the two sides of the table have tended not to appreciate the constraints that the others were operating under. And that's certainly my sense. I've been to both the West Bank and Israel proper, and you talk to the people on the two sides, and you get what you would expect, which is both of them have historical narratives that encourage them to feel like the aggrieved party. And God knows they both have hard histories, but impedes sometimes understanding each other the way as might be valuable.
Yeah. Yeah, I can understand that. And that's something I work with on a very personal and family level. I think what it's reminding me of too are some of the equivalencies I see that come up around this so often. One is speaking to a colleague back when we were speaking, unfortunately we haven't spoken since, who's based in Israel in Tel Aviv. And we have some shared spiritual lineage and some other shared background stuff. So we had a conversation soon after October 7th about what had just happened. It's like a week after, so it's still pretty fresh. And part of what we talked about from his point of view, and I can see this and acknowledge this is true, from the Israeli standpoint, there's a moral equivalency that's often drawn between the people living in Palestine, the people in Israel. And I don't know how you feel about adult developmental psychological models, Bob. I've never heard you talk about them, so I'm not sure how familiar you are with them or how much you like them or don't. But the idea that humans keep developing past, Jung was one of the first people to say it, humans keep developing past 18 years old, some of them, not all of them. And in some ways, there's different dimensions of development. But his point was like, in Israel, we have democracy, we have all these values, and they're living in like a relative barbarism. He didn't say that, use these words, but this is the basic message. And I think there's something similar that happens here in America with the conversation about Black America, where it's like, well, it's often used as an argument. It was like people who are white and rich and who've had like great environments for learning for generations just seem to be like get stuff that people who haven't had all of those advantages don't. You know, and now I'm being honest about my point of view, which is like, this is, if you understand why some people have so much advantage and end up being able to develop themselves and flourish in ways that others can't because of systematic oppression or systematic marginalization, then you see that while that moral equivalency thing is true from the point of view of the individual, the reason it's true is because of cultural trends. And for me, it's hard as a Palestinian to not be like, hey, one of the major important things in contemporary history to understand is like you've got one party occupying the other. And this is the second equivalency I see, which is a lot of times people talk about these as they're at war, two parties at war. It's like, no, you can't be at war when one has a power over position of the other. That's torture. Like when you have power over someone and you start to be violent to them, that's called torture. That's not called war. For me, it's like that's another equivalency. It's like there's a power equivalency here. I think if you zoom out and say there's always been this sort of violent history, then you miss like what's the current present, because this is what's unfolding right now. And I hear you about the aggrieved victim mentality, and that's what causes people to become persecutors in the psychological language, right? Like then the drama triangle, Karpman's drama triangle. You go from victim to persecutor because you're trying to protect yourself. And I see this in myself, like I do this all the time. And I see whole peoples doing it. I see the Israelis doing it. I see Palestinians, some of them doing it with Hamas. And that's how the cycles of violence continue, it seems like. And what interrupts it? Because there's enablers here, like the US and the UK are the rescuers or the enablers in this drama triangle. And we're not taking responsibility as a country for the way that we've enabled the situation. We never did it for 9/11 either. We never took responsibility as a country for the enabling conditions that led to the attack on our own soil.
Yeah, I definitely think we have not done Israel a favor by being so uncritical, by providing such uncritical support.
Right.
And in a certain sense, indulging its narrative a little too much.
You're right.
Look, Israel does have a history that naturally leads to vigilance, to put it mildly. It's been, until recently, it had reason to feel surrounded by hostile Arab states, certainly 30 years ago or something. And that's a position in America, we don't know what it's like to be in that position. And I think that mindset persists and...
No, we only know what it's like to bomb Arabs from afar.
But that's another thing, by the way, that I was going to say. When you talk about both Israel and America, it's easy for them to call other people barbarians and savages because we have the luxury of deploying violence by remote control, and we are not the ones who have to use suicide bombers if we want to get somebody's attention. Not that I'm justifying suicide bombing any more than I'm justifying...
It was military dominance, is what you're describing.
But, yeah, look... How is it not barbaric to have now killed, I don't know, close to 1 in 40 Gazans and probably maimed about that many again? I don't know what the exact number is. Most of them civilians. When it's clearly not necessary. You just cannot argue that this is necessary from Israel's strategic point of view at this point. It's that it's Israel. Now, to be clear, I think a lot of Israelis have convinced themselves that it is. And this is part of the problem with the world. People do. They convince themselves of their narratives, but this is where I think the U.S. has done Israel a disservice. Just too many uncritical hugs and too many weapons.
Sorry, that was funny in a not funny way. Oh, my gosh.
Those are part of the hugs. The weapons are uncritically provided, unconditionally provided.
Yeah, I understand that. And I have a number of close friends who are... have served in the military and were in the military industrial complex their whole lives so far. And I've had some candid conversations with them about like the U.S. is not leaving the Middle East because it's such an important military point. And like, we have so many bases there.
Yeah, but the logic is circular at a certain point. We have to have the bases because we have the bases.
No, for sure. I agree with you. I'm just saying, like, the idea that we're not going to give up our unipolar military dominance. And that those are from people inside of the military industrial complex. That's their point of view. And so I just like, okay, that's probably how the system looks at itself. It's not going to let go. And so what do you, like, for me, I ask the question, what do I do as a person living in this society at this time, with these religious beliefs and psychology, and how do I respond to this moment? For me, largely, it's been hard to talk about what's going on. So it feels scary to even talk about, to record stuff publicly. And I'm like, why is it scary? Partially because, like, Palestinian American green card holders are being like imprisoned for no reason. And those are like, a lot of my family members are green card holders who came here in the 90s from Kuwait. So it's like that kind of one degree of separation of people I'm seeing could be arrested for just having effectively using their voice, not even doing anything violent.
Yeah, and Trump would like to be able to also just suppress dissent in the media, including any speech he considers unduly critical of Israel. He says it's all about a war on anti-Semitism, but it's pretty clear that's not the entirety of the agenda.
Anyone who's critical of Israel must be an anti-Semite is not a proposition you can hold up for long.
That's amazing.
Not to say there aren't a lot of anti-Semitic arguments being thrown around.
Oh, no, there are. There is anti-Semitism. But I think what Israel is doing is making it worse.
Sadly, yeah.
Which, by the way, is supposedly an anti-Semitic thing to say by some lights. The Israel speech code is so complicated, but it used to be, and it's changing. I will say the Overton window is changing in terms of what you can say, but it used to be that if you said that Israel could do anything, even in principle, that would make anti-Semitism worse, that was somehow, I actually understand what the theoretical argument was of why they said that was anti-Semitic. But in truth, it was just another way to discourage hard criticism of Israel. It's ridiculous to say that if I say, look, I think there are some anti-Semites out there who are already conflating Israel and Jews, who are already conflating Zionism with Judaism. Yes, right. It's a confused conflation, but they're doing it. So right. If Israel kills another 10,000 people, that may inflame these people, the anti-Semitism in these people specifically, okay? Pretty obvious, right? That is going to happen to some extent. But for a long time, you weren't supposed to say that. That was, I swear, that was supposedly a sign you were anti-Semitic. By some lights, this wasn't, it was a somewhat extreme view maybe, but anyway, it's now the whole thing is so sad and depressing. I just can't believe it's going on still. And we're supplying them with the weapons.
Shocking to me to think like the Jewish Holocaust went on for 12 years. I was like, wow. Obviously, it wasn't live streamed, but just
no, it was not
crazy to think about.
It was not by contemporary standards, it wasn't conspicuous at all. But it is amazing. It's a different world now in a lot of ways. But it would be impossible to do anything on that scale without it being very apparent to the world.
Bob,
that's a good thing about modern technology. Sorry, go ahead.
No, absolutely. I agree with you. It is a good thing in a way. You were talking about kind of the conflation of Israeli and Jewish identities, and that's something I've run across in having some difficult conversations with my own teachers who are Jewish American Jews. And I heard one of them say to me, I really hate that I keep being conflated with Israelis because I don't know anyone in Israel. I don't have any connections to Israel, et cetera. And I'm like, yeah, I totally hear that. And it isn't a fair conflation. But like you said, it's Netanyahu and it's Israel that's making that conflation over and over again publicly. And so for me, the perspective I shared with her was like, if your identity is being weaponized in this way, you have a moral obligation to contradict that narrative. And I saw for this teacher, who's a very, like one of the most mature, awakened, realized people I know, literally, even with this topic, it's very difficult. It's very, do you want to test the edges of your enlightenment? Okay. And I think they, to their credit, I see them really genuinely wrestling with this stuff and growing around it, which is all I can ask as a reasonable person.
How old is this person roughly?
They're 80 now. So they're definitely in the boomer tradition.
First of all, you're right about Netanyahu. He explicitly encourages the conflation. right. of Israel with Jews and Judaism with Zionism. And he does it all the time. In fact, a few weeks ago, he thanked somebody for something. And he said, on behalf of the world's Jews. On what basis do you speak for the world's Jews? You're heading a country that, yes, it's the Jewish state, but there's a lot of Jews who aren't citizens of your country, man. Anyway, the generational thing is really important. Big, right? Somebody, yeah. 80, let's see, if you do the math, their parents could easily be Holocaust survivors. I guess they couldn't quite remember. No, they could not. They were born right at the end of World War II, right? And even people my generation, which sadly isn't that far from this person's generation, but my Jewish friends, you know, were brought up in, by and large, not all, in an environment that was so conscious of the Holocaust, often because they had close relatives who were Holocaust survivors. And understandably, the mantra was never forget. And understandably became an important part of the ethnic narrative. Whereas my daughter's friends, maybe they have a grandparent, but probably not even. Maybe they have a grandparent who is a Holocaust survivor. There are very few living Holocaust survivors. So,
sure.
And so I think that's one reason for the generational change.
Yeah,
but
right.
It is very hard for any of us, as old as I am or older, including 80, you know, to fundamentally change our basic sensibility. And the kind of sensitivity that this person is evincing that you described was imbued deeply at a young age.
Yeah, for sure. And I had my own historical family narratives, things that I heard, which were actually surprisingly kind to Jews on the whole. I was always surprised by how many Jewish friends my grandfather had and how he never spoke ill of Jewish people. Although later in his life, he became more conspiratorial and he found these weird ways to vent his anti-Semitism that was actually present. How could it fucking not be?
Where was he displaced from? Where was his home?
He was in the West Bank area. I'm sorry, he was outside of his family had land in a couple different places. They were displaced from outside of Jerusalem, about 30 minutes drive. And then they had also land in the West Bank. So they were able to go from one place to the other, fortunately. At least for a little while. Yeah, I don't know. I appreciate you taking the time to have this conversation. It's a difficult one. And I really, it's odd too, because what I've seen is like Palestinians are in a position to really empathize with Jews in a way that almost no one else can, and vice versa, mm-hmm. because of mm-hmm. the shared histories and how similar they are in a lot of ways. Like I find it's much easier for me when I'm not inflamed to be able to relate. I'm like, I can totally understand if you've been part of a persecuted minority that you'd want to hide that part of your identity, that you wouldn't want to even look at it, or you just want to be, okay, I'm white. That's fine. I'll just pass as white. And that's something that I grew up with. It's like this experience of feeling there's part of me that was not safe to be. And so when there's part of you that's not safe to be, what you'll end up doing is hiding, repressing that part, right? You actually will actively ignore that part, and and there's this kind of self-violence that you do to yourself in order to fit in so that you're not dealing with external violence constantly. And the problem is you have to dehumanize yourself, so you're dehumanized by others less. And if you never heal from that, if you don't like actually come out of the closet, as it were, and own your identity that's been marginalized, then what happens is you're in a position to be able to re-perpetuate that trauma with other people. And I've seen it with some of my own family members who cannot even talk about it. It's so painful for them. They can't even go there. And I think, that's the people that I'm most scared for, because that's the type of trauma that leads to acting out violence, I think. Whereas if you see someone who's pissed and angry, like I am, like maybe you should be scared of me, but not really. I'm owning it. I'm a pissed off Arab, like Palestinian guy. I don't like what's happening to my family. And I don't like how we're showing up with our humanistic world values as Buddhists, and we're not really living it. It's like, come on.
Yeah. No, in that sense, you're right. Palestinians and Jews, and maybe Israeli Jews in particular, have more in common.
Yeah.
than I have with either of them. I didn't even have a very distinct ethnic tribe. I was brought up Christian. I'm no longer Christian. And the thing about Christianity is, once you're not a Christian, like, you're not a Christian. It's like you can leave the church in a way that can't really happen with Judaism. I have a Jewish friend who once said to me, so you're a Christian. And he knew I was no longer believing Christian. I didn't go to church. But he said that, but I think because with Jewish identity, that's kind of the way it is. It's not like about right. whether you go to synagogue. It's just your identity.
It's more of an ethnic kind of religious complex.
Well, it's a very distinctive and unusual form of ethnic identity, the combination of a religious and non-religious. But
yeah, sure.
But anyway, I don't have, I said earlier, I don't have a dog in this fight. It isn't just that. I don't have a lot of experience with tribal identity, just the ethnic type, firsthand. Now, we're all parts
right.
of tribe.
Okay.
We all are prey to the psychology of tribalism. It's like, I'm anti-Trump, and I
right.
see how that shapes
tribalism.
So it's the same psychology. I understand psychology generically, but at the same time, you may have deeper insights into the way some Jewish Israelis look at things than I'm capable of. I don't know.
Yeah, maybe. But I think one thing I notice generally with the psychology of people that I talk to about these issues is like, they're generally people that want to be world-centric. Like they want to be caring about all people, regardless of their backgrounds. And I'm not really talking to a lot of just pure on tribalist fundamentalists. I know them and I have some that are neighbors, and it's not like I avoid these people. It's just, that's not what I'm having these dialogues with, because I don't think they would be that fruitful. But like, the people I'm talking to, they want to be seen as being pluralistic and tolerating difference. But in reality, like in terms of what they say or do, or more importantly, don't do, like they really don't care that much, or they're not really doing anything that indicates that they care that what's happening in Gaza. And I've seen that time and time again, even from close friends. Or like empathetic word is very different than, are you actually saying or doing anything to support this? Or are you just like saying a kind word to a friend and that's it? It's the latter. And so that's where I have an increasing respect for activists, wise activists, people that are taking a moral stand. And I think they're much more mature and developed than us spiritual navel gazers are in a lot of ways, in terms of the contemplation and action side of things. I've been realizing that as I've been pulled into action. And one thing I wanted to say there is like people that want to see themselves as being world-centric, but actually have these ethnocentric drives that are repressed. Like, because we don't want to appear as being tribalistic. And if you're white in America, you have to repress a lot of your ethnic identity to be white, because white isn't a fucking ethnic category.
Yeah, you get back to what I was saying. It's maybe I have a tribe, I just don't have to be conscious of it, especially
that's a tragedy
in America
for you.
Was whiter. Yeah, maybe. Yeah.
You don't have access to your ancestral wisdom. That'd be one way of putting it.
Yeah, I identify culturally with just kind of West Texas culture, because that's where my parents are from. But even there, I didn't really grow up there. I lived in different parts of Texas. But because my father joined the Army, we moved around.
Where were your folks from? Did they hail from Europe somewhere? Like, what was your... You know, probably from many places.
There weren't many recent immigrants. Ultimately, mainly Scottish, English, a little Irish,
yeah,
mainly.
It's like most of my family, too. Not
yeah.
The non-Arab side.
Yeah.
The Irish, that's a great one to explore, because like Irish people experienced terrible persecution in recent modern history.
Yeah, I finally took a 23andMe test and found I wasn't as much Irish as I might have thought. It was like 15%. But there's a long story about Scots-Irish and what that really means. It actually doesn't mean Irish by bloodline.
Okay.
Scots-Irish, which I am heavily, refers to a population of Scottish people who went to Ireland, stayed there intact, and then migrated to America. But from 23andMe's point of view, they're just Scottish.
Okay.
And I think I have a lot of Scots-Irish.
Yeah. My grandmother's Scots-Irish, the one that married my Palestinian grandfather. And I always thought like part of what drew them together was some kind of karmic connection around both having experienced sort of the British Empire, the negative effects of the British Empire.
Yeah, no, the Scots-Irish, they were almost pushed to Ireland in the first place. They weren't well received there because of the religious differences.
Right.
They were religious dissenters in England, in a sense. They were Presbyterians, which was a minority. And then obviously Presbyterians weren't enthusiastically embraced back then in Ireland. And then they came to America and supposedly had a series of rough experiences there too. I don't know. They kept putting them on the frontier as the buffer with the Native Americans and encouraging them to go out and deal with the Native Americans while they sat back on the coast. You know.
Interesting.
There's a whole
the history of America, there is a lot of religious persecution in that history where it was founded on a lot of persecution, right? Like people were coming here to escape.
Oh, yeah.
Religious persecution or their history in some other way.
Yeah, no, the first wave, you got the Puritans and then Scots-Irish were a big part of a subsequent migration. And yeah.
So there you go. You got a bunch of people who are persecuted who come here and end up doing what? Yeah. It's like the same damn pattern.
I guess I can relate now that I think about it to both
the
tribes in the conflict we're talking about.
Yeah, because we all come from them.
I am persecuted, damn it.
Persecutor and persecuted. We all have some of each of in us, I think.
I'm on both ends of the deal.